From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The summit between President Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un is just days away, but the Trump administration's rhetoric against the North hasn't stopped. In Israel yesterday, Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani said the president was right to cancel the summit recently after North Korea insulted Vice President Mike Pence and National Security Advisor John Bolton.
We said, we're not going to have a summit under those circumstances. Well, Kim Jong-un got back on his hands and knees and begged for it, which is exactly the position you want to put him in.
CNN international correspondent Will Ripley will be in Singapore for the summit if it happens. Today he joins us from Beijing on Skype. And Will, how are people there where you are responding to this Giuliani comment?
Well, look, I don't think you have to be a North Korea expert to cringe when you hear somebody from the U.S. administration using language like this. I mean, it was John Bolton's Libya model remarks that almost killed the summit. Now there are some reports out of the White House that that might have actually been a deliberate attempt. And now you have to wonder, what is Giuliani thinking to say that the leader of North Korea got down on his hands and knees and begged for a summit? Obviously, the North Koreans are going to read that. And this is not going to be productive or helpful in the days leading up to this already pretty sensitive summit where you have a lot of mistrust, especially on the North Korean side, and a lot of anger about some of the comments that have been made from the Trump administration.
And what about from the perspective of Prime Minister Abe from Japan? How are they viewing this? Do they think this summit is going to happen? Do they like this shift in rhetoric at all?
Well, you know, Prime Minister Abe was right in the Trump camp and a lot of the other North Korea hawks for much of the last 2 years. You know, they were very supportive of the maximum pressure campaign. And so when President Trump suddenly agreed to this meeting in the first place, Japan was taken by surprise. In many ways, they were really sidelined here. They're now trying to salvage something out of it. They want President Trump to bring up their most important issue domestically, which is the abduction, the unsolved abductions of Japanese citizens in the late 70s and early 80s. President Trump has said he's going to do that. The North Koreans have dismissed that in some of their own state media reports, saying that the abduction issue has already been resolved. So at the moment, Japan is just trying to kind of be along for the ride, but they're really not in any way a key player in this, although they've been trying to meet with President Trump to make sure that their voice is heard and their viewpoints are brought up at the summit.
There's a lot of fear in this country that Kim Jong-un is not really serious about denuclearization. You've been inside North Korea more than a dozen times. What do you think is going to happen here?
Well, look, I went to the Punggye-ri nuclear test site, apparent destruction, and we saw a lot of theatrics. North Korea blew up the log cabins at the site, which wasn't really necessary. We know that those could be rebuilt. Experts who have seen the size of the explosions that we witnessed pointed out that it's standing only 500 meters away. We were still very safe. Had North Korea actually irreparably collapsed the tunnels that go deep into the mountains at Punggye-ri, the explosions would have been larger. We might not have even been able to view it safely from where we were. That said, there are some intelligence reports out that they might be dismantling some of their missile launch facilities. Again, we know from the destruction of the cooling tower at Yongbyon in 2008 that these types of things can be rebuilt if talks go south. A lot of people in South Korea, certainly with the progressive administration of Moon Jae-in, do feel that North Korea is sincere here. But clearly, based on history and you know, past mistakes and past failed agreements, there is a lot of skepticism out there.
Well, and if they do come out at the end of the summit, Trump and Kim, and say, we've reached a deal, North Korea is going to denuclearize, do you think that we can take that seriously, or are we going to come back in 6 months and say, oh, actually, it didn't happen?
The key is going to be how this deal will be verified, because this will be the most difficult deal in history to actually verify, given limited access to North Korea. Is Kim Jong-un really going to allow international inspectors to the most sensitive areas in his country to make sure that the promises that are made are kept? So there should be skepticism over whatever broad statement is made at the end of the Singapore summit as to whether those steps can actually be enforced.
What about the view from South Korea? What are they thinking? And do they really believe that the Korean War, which has been going on for decades, could be finally nearing an end?
Well, President Moon Jae-in has approval ratings above 75%. I mean, he's staked all of his political capital on trying to turn a new page in history with North Korea. That's what he ran on after the impeachment of Park Geun-hye, and the public has overwhelmingly supported him. And they've seen the optics at the inter-Korean summit, the amazing pictures of Kim Jong-un and Moon Jae-in taking a walk and having a chat. And public opinion inside South Korea is actually shifting more in the favor of North Koreans. A lot of South Koreans who said they didn't trust Kim Jong-un before now say that they do. So look, the South Koreans and certainly their government want this to work, because it means that their lives are going to be a lot more stable in the short term. And in the long term, if the two Koreas can actually work together economically, there could be really tremendous opportunities. You're talking trillions of dollars in economic opportunities when you look at North Korea's commodities that they have that are not being mined properly at the moment. I mean, there's a lot of investment and a lot of money to be made if this works, especially for the South Koreans, but really for, you know, people all over the world.
Have you got a refundable ticket to Singapore? Because, I mean, how sure are you this is going to happen?
You know, yes, we always book refundable tickets because you never know at the end of the day. I mean, all of the dozens of hotel rooms that, you know, CNN and the other networks have booked, you need to be always aware that this could fall apart. And I think everybody has walked into this with their eyes wide open. But in Singapore, when I was just there last week, I mean, they're taking steps to try to make this happen. They'll have a few more days to handle a lot of the, you know, difficult logistical challenges. Where is Kim Jong-un going to stay? Who's going to pay for it? Where is President Trump going to stay? What about security? What about press availability?
And we still don't know those details.
Right. We still don't know. We're getting little drips of information from the White House. I'm not sure that they fully know yet, to be honest. Hmm.
That's Will Ripley, who is CNN's international correspondent, joining us today from Beijing. Will, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks, Jeremy.
Well, it's a big sports day, so let's check in. In hockey, the Washington Capitals are a win away from their first Stanley Cup title, but they still have to beat the passionate Golden Knights in Las Vegas. In basketball, the Golden State Warriors are also a win away from another title after beating LeBron James, I mean the Cavaliers, last night in Cleveland. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, the Golden making the finals in their first season, but thousands of Washington fans we'll watch tonight's game at home in the Cavs arena. They're psyched, too. How do you see this?
Yeah, well, I don't see it from the Cavs arena because they sold out those tickets. I don't know if you sell out free tickets, but in 20 minutes, people said, yes, we want to watch a Jumbotron for the chance to be with fellow Caps fans as our team wins its first Stanley Cup title ever. They've been in the league since 73-74, and they have on many occasions had the best team, won what's called the President's Trophy, which is the best record, and then they get bounced from the playoffs.
Right.
Here's the stat. So in Stanley Cup playoffs, one team is up 3-1. As the Caps are, they have won 32 of the 33 Stanley Cups. However, when the Caps are up 3-1 in series in the playoffs, they have often lost.
Right.
They've lost to the Islanders. They've lost to the Penguins.
Right.
So Caps fans are not counting this one until maybe the last empty net goal if it comes to that.
So either way, though, it's going to be a great story because either it's the brand new team after a horrific, you know, shooting in Las Vegas that might pull it out, or it's a team that's been in a drought. Either way. Switching to the NBA. The Warriors, overwhelming favorites, and the Cavs probably blew their best chance to win a game when J.R. Smith, sorry to remind you, Mr. Smith, didn't realize the score was tied in game one. He held onto the ball, failed to take a shot after he got that rebound. Ouch. But is this series over?
But he admitted it, and that's the important thing. No, that's not the important thing. The important thing is that he screwed it up. It's not over because it's a best of seven series, and, you know, he got to win four, but it's over. Last night, the Cavs came out hard, but really coming out hard against the Warriors doesn't really matter. The Warriors are this amazing third quarter team, and they are so dominant and have such an amazing point differential in the third that often their games aren't even close when they've been trailing for double digits, as was the case in the first half. Their team, so as I've said on your show before, our show, LeBron's the best player on the court, and then the next four or five are the best players are Warriors. They just have such a complete team. And, you know, Kevin Durant had 43 points, and he's a juggernaut. They have so many good players.
Look, I just want to touch on the intersection between sports and politics, and in this case, we need a stoplight. We want to listen to what LeBron James said about President Trump's decision to rescind his invitation to the Super Bowl-winning Philadelphia Eagles to the White House after hearing many of them weren't going to come anyway because of the president's stance on some of them not standing during the national anthem. They were protesting, of course, police shootings of unarmed black men. Here's what LeBron James said.
We have a lot of freedom in our country, and guys, men or female, have the right to do what they want to do. I think if they decided they don't want to go, then they have the right.
Mike, where's this going? Do you see a change maybe in the way players approach contracts or maybe trying to force their unions to protect them when they're in negotiations, when they're in protest?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the NBA is pretty comfortable where it is. And it's not just LeBron saying it. The Golden State coach, Steve Kerr, said the president is turning all this into a political game and a ratings game. And it's a blatant display of nationalism. So I think NFL players maybe would seek redress through their union. But the other possibility is that Donald Trump, if you believe what Kerr is saying and putting this into a political game, you know, he thinks that he has the better of it, but maybe he doesn't. You know, maybe there will be some blowback for these stances that he's taken in this fight that he's picked with the most popular sport in America, despite his efforts, and also with the most popular team in the swing state of Pennsylvania, which doesn't seem particularly smart to me.
Okay, lightning round. Saturday, Justify has a chance to win horse racing's Triple Crown in the Belmont Stakes. American Pharoah's Triple Crown in 2015 was the first since 78. This could be another 3 years later, you think?
I would say no, except that American Pharoah showed that it could be done. What's so hard is to race these young horses, teenagers, yeah. I mean, they're three-year-olds, so close together. It's just an endurance test. However, Justify is so much better than every horse I've seen.
I just have to say, stupidest question of the week, from Bill Simons of Inside Tennis to Serena Williams asking her if she was intimidated by Maria Sharapova's supermodel looks. She said, nothing intimidates me. Mike Pesca, Here Now Sports Analyst. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Yesterday, we introduced you to Daniel Grossman, a childhood friend of mine who's now a doctor at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Last year, a mountain biking accident left him paralyzed, starting a few inches above his belly button. He's had to relearn how to do basic things, like lifting himself or transferring from his bed into his wheelchair. And from his wheelchair to the ground and back.
And reposition my feet.
Yep.
Be straight. Bring my knees in.
And you want to tuck them back as far as you can.
Yep.
That was 9 months ago. Today, Daniel's more comfortable in his wheelchair and has gone back to work as an ER doctor. But he's still concerned about falling out of the chair, something that's already happened to him a few times, including while he was staying at a hotel near the Mayo Clinic.
I was transferring from the toilet to my wheelchair, and I missed the transfer. I'd practiced this transfer a whole bunch of times, but I missed it, and I ended up on the ground. Now, I had also practiced getting from the ground up back onto the chair, but it's different to do that in physical therapy on a mat than it is to do naked in the middle of a tile floor with the chair not solidly held or against the wall.
Mm-hmm.
So I called a nurse from Mayo, and she came and helped me get up. And that was my worst fear. So later that evening, one of the occupational therapists from Mayo came over to my hotel room, and we practiced transfers from toilet to chair, toilet to chair, toilet to chair. And she's like, okay, you've got it. I said, good. Let's do a few more. And then the next day, we did it again. And the only answer to overcoming the fear and the skill is to keep doing things until you're comfortable doing it.
How are you?
On the day we visited, Daniel took us up to the third floor of the hospital, where many doctors recognized him. This is where he started learning how to navigate the world from a wheelchair.
This is the acute rehab unit, and I was up here for 64 days. So this is the room I was in, 42. It was home for 2 months.
What is it like to be back here?
It feels good. I mean, I graduated from this place, and sort of it feels like a bit of a homecoming and a bit of a graduation. And
how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
Good. Back to work, I see you.
Back to work.
Jeez. No rest.
Hey, can't rest. Got things to do.
Yeah, you do. Got life to live, right? Good to see you.
You too.
So you feel like you have good memories of this place?
Yeah, look, I hated being here from the sense of I'm in the hospital, but it was really good for me. The nursing care is fantastic. The physicians are great. And I, at the end of the day, have really, really positive memories of learning how to get back on my feet, so to speak.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well.
Dr. Kristen Garlinger leads Daniel's rehab team at Mayo. She pops out of her office to tell Daniel how impressed she is by the speed of his recovery.
I think that you don't settle, that it takes a special individual to take barriers and make them into opportunities, and I think you were that way before injury, and so that's kind of what gave you the upper hand compared to maybe other individuals who don't have that inherent personality. Yeah.
Personality matters in other areas of life as well, including dating. Daniel is single, and I asked him about that.
What about the single part? What do you think that your relationships will look like in the future?
I would love to be in a relationship and would love to have children. That is a primary goal of mine. And so, therefore, a big fear of mine as well. But plenty of stories exist of people starting relationships after having spinal cord injuries and having children. I don't see why that would be any different for me.
Have you had a date yet?
Yep.
Yeah?
I've had a few dates. And it is a self-selected population because I'm pretty upfront about the fact that I'm in a wheelchair. And so either they're okay with it or they knew me before.
Hmm.
Is it easy? No.
It sounds like none of this is easy.
None of this is easy. It will all become easier. It's only been 9 months.
Right.
And I have to keep that in perspective.
According to the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation, people with spinal cord injuries are 2 to 3 times more likely than the general population to show signs of severe depression. People with spinal cord injuries are also at a higher risk of attempting suicide.
You wrote in one of your early blog posts, because you started blogging about what was going on, that you were able to be mostly in good spirits, but you were sometimes sad and it would come and go.
Yeah, early on, I think I realized what the ramifications were, not just for me, but for everyone in my life. And I sort of had to pick between two divergent paths really early on. Option A is you are paralyzed. What are you going to do about it? Option B is you are paralyzed. Let's sit and wallow in self-pity.
Hmm.
And I decided for option A. And honestly, I think most people do decide for option A. But option B seems really easy. That like self-pity component seems pretty reasonable.
There are approximately 300,000 Americans living with spinal cord injuries. And Daniel's not the only one who's also a doctor. One is Dr. Francisco Sanchez at Harvard, who recorded himself doing procedures to help Daniel learn how to do them. Another is right here at the Mayo Clinic, Dr. Robert Brown, a neurologist who has used a wheelchair since he was 14 and who became a mentor for Daniel during his recovery.
And you've got, by the way, a perfectly pressed suit on, a perfectly tied tie. Daniel's been talking to us about how difficult it is sometimes to get dressed.
Yeah.
How do you make this happen?
Well, as Daniel perhaps mentioned to you, I've used a wheelchair to get around for a long time. Mm-hmm. This dates back, 40 plus years. And so this is the type of thing you just get used to, if you will, as years go by. And one was one of the things Daniel and I talked about when I first got to meet him. And we talked about this transition to the new normal, if you will, in Daniel's life and the various aspects of one's world that one needs to get used to as you participate not only in your personal life, but in your professional life. You just get very used to how to put things together in the morning, you know, as you're getting ready to come in. And
you just get used to it.
You get used
practice
to it.
Practice makes
it,
perfect.
And it doesn't take very long. It probably doesn't take me a whole lot longer than it would somebody who's not using a wheelchair. My message to Daniel was that one's life can be absolute, as full, and as much of a celebration of life as it would have been prior to the accident.
One of the things our listeners can definitely hear from you is you're very upbeat.
Yeah.
How important is the attitude? And have you said anything to Daniel about that.
Yeah. Well, we talked about that early on, and my immediate perspective as I got to know Daniel in that setting is he has a very upbeat personality by nature, and that's the way I was as well. When I was initially paralyzed 40 years ago, and I think my parents would be the first to say this, I was the one who was trying to reassure them that this is going to be okay. You know, we'll just work through it over the course of time. It'll be fine. And that was just in my nature at age 14 that for whatever reason, and I think it's a very good thing that it was the case, that the more you're able to appreciate what you're able to do, despite the fact you're using a wheelchair to get around, as opposed to the things that you can't do or an obstacle in your place, you're going to be much better off and readily be able to work through whatever obstacles that might be in front of you.
As we continued to talk to Dr. Brown, Daniel was listening across the room. He wheeled over to say something himself.
So we've talked a lot about inspiration. And when you rolled into my room the first day, pristinely dressed, and you didn't treat me like a patient. You treated me like a colleague. And that, for me, was actually inspirational because you came in and said, you know, you can do all the things you want to do. And you have one choice to make. And that is, do you want to do the things or do you want to choose an alternative path as you described? And I want to say thank you because you immediately alleviated my fear of travel. You immediately alleviated my fear of not being able to get back to a profession that I cared deeply and passionately about. And you showed me that you can live professionally, you can live personally, and you can do all of these things successfully. So as much as we've harped on the word inspirational, the impact you made on my life when you came and visited multiple times without any difficulty was incredible, and I want to say thank you.
Well, thank you. It means the world to me that you say that, Daniel. And as a colleague and now a close friend, it's just fantastic for me to see how well you're doing. And for many, many years to come, I'll look forward to assisting in any way I can.
Thank you.
Daniel still keeps the helmet he was wearing the day of his accident. It's cracked, but it also saved his life. He's also started biking again, on a bike operated with hand pedals. We've got photos and videos of Daniel on our website. That's hereandnow.org.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
And now to that obituary in the Redwood Falls Gazette in tiny Redwood Falls, Minnesota, on the passing of 80-year-old Kathleen Denlow. We'll post it, but basically it says, Kathleen married Dennis in 1957 and had two children, then became pregnant by her husband's brother and abandoned her children. She will not be missed by her children, who understand this is a better world without her. Ouch. Heather Lendes wrote the book on obituaries. It's called Find the Good. She's in Haines, Alaska. Heather, have you ever seen one this bad?
Yes, I think so. Maybe worse. And this one at least was brief.
There's that to it. Well, as we told you when we spoke back in 2015, we read obituaries. And here's one recently, 2017, for Leslie Ray Charping on the Carn Funeral Home website in Houston. Leslie was surprisingly intelligent. However, he lacked ambition to do anything more than be reckless and squander the family savings. His hobbies included being abusive to his family. Now, his daughter said she wasn't sorry because she needed to tell the truth. I mean, is that what you find is behind these? Really, it's almost like revenge obituaries.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a fan of them. An obituary is a death announcement in the paper with a biography. I don't think there's any reason to pass judgment. If there's nothing nice to say, you just stick to the basic biographical outline and leave it at that.
Well, you know, when you come to Kathleen Denlow's, the speculation is that one of her children did write it, and another relative who's not talking now said, you know, there's more to the story than that. But if you're the child of someone who indeed left you as a child and became pregnant by your uncle and had another family in another state, you know, maybe it's cathartic.
I guess. I mean, after I read it, I just felt sad for everyone, for the mother, for her children, for the family, her friends, you know. And I also wondered, what about the other child? Were there more? Did Kathleen marry her brother-in-law and have a good life in California? You know, was it a disastrous affair that she never recovered from? And the idea that, you know, 50 years later, her grown children were still so hurt mm-hmm. and so angry about it made me, I don't know, I was just sorry.
Well, this is what we love about you and why we highly recommend your book, Find the Good, because obituaries are these compelling stories that pull us in and we want to know more about the families while we're feeling for their humanity. And I rush to tell you that in all the comments that came after this, there were people who were standing up for Kathleen Demlow. In fact, one woman from Redwood Falls said she wanted to host a celebration of the deceased woman's life at her home. So maybe, in fact, a negative obituary can evoke another response as well.
In many ways, it mirrors the op-ed pages, I guess. And, you know, it just seems to me that the world, you know, needs a lot more love and understanding and kindness, not meanness, which is not to say that you have to be dishonest in an obituary. And I think that if I had been the editor, I would have talked to the children about their choice of words. And if they insisted on including, you know, this sentiment, would have tried to find someone who had a good relationship with her to comment. You know, her sister. It said she lived with her sister or a neighbor.
Well, by the way, we should say that there's a tweet from the paper saying that the editors did not want to run it. They were overruled. And then they ultimately did pull it. Author Heather Lendy, her book about obituaries, again, it's just wonderful. It's called Find the Good. Heather, thank you.
Well, thanks very much for talking with me.
President Trump continues to flex his pardoning power. Yesterday, he commuted the life sentence of Alice Marie Johnson, who spent more than two decades in federal prison in Alabama on nonviolent drug charges. Her case was championed by Kim Kardashian West, who met with the president last week. It's worth noting there are more than 2,000 federal prisoners currently serving life sentences for nonviolent drug crimes. We'll see if the president pardons them. Meanwhile, let's look back at the history of the pardon with Brian Ballow and Joanne Freeman, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Welcome back.
Thanks for having
us. Good to be here.
Now, the pardon is in the Constitution, right? This goes back to the very beginning of the country.
It does indeed. It's in Article 2, Section 2, Clause 1 of the Constitution, and it does give the president a rather undefined ability to pardon people. Now, the theory at the time was, you know, if we think nowadays it sounds a little bit monarchical or king-like, the fact is, yes, it does, because the founders were modeling themselves after the British monarchy, and the idea in Britain was that their legal system was rather punitive. And so rather than inflict the death penalty on someone, the king had the power to grant a royal pardon. Mm-hmm. So it was seen as a way to deal with an inflexible or extreme situation of justice. And so
and it let when him come across as a good guy too, right?
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't even thought about that, but he gets to be the guy who grants the pardon. So he gets all the good PR. I don't think they were thinking about PR at the Federal Convention, though. Hamilton, actually, in The Federalist, talks a little bit about the logic, and he's kind of mirroring what happened in England. You know, he says it's possible that you would need some kind of a quick action to deal with something that's too punitive or perhaps in a time of rebellion. A quick pardon will calm everybody down, so it makes sense to give the president that power.
Well, and you say quick pardon. Brian, tell us a little bit about the process, the formal process of doing this.
Well, certainly for the, you know, the modern presidency, it's been pretty bureaucratic. I mean, you need to submit a form. I don't know whether in triplicate or not, but you need to submit this form to the Department of Justice. And there's an office that handles this and they vet it. And they often talk to the prosecutors. They talk to the people involved in the case. And they have guidelines. And those guidelines suggest that, well, it's really best if the crime that you were convicted for happened at least 5 years ago. It's a bureaucratic administrative process. However, that does go to the president, and it is entirely up to the president to decide whether he wants to follow the advice of his Justice Department.
It is not just individuals who have been pardoned in this country's history. There have been mass pardons, Joanne, like when President Lincoln pardoned the rebels in 1863.
Indeed, right? So the Civil War raises an extreme problem, which is you have half the country which has committed war against the other half of the country. And what do you do with people who've rebelled against the government? So the question of a mass pardon comes up. Lincoln wants to give a mass pardon with kind of not very punitive demands. The radical Republicans in Congress want punitive demands, and this is debated for a while as to whether this can or can't be done. Obviously, the war continues on. But it's interesting to note that after the war, when they really had to deal with the question of what do you do with Confederates, Jefferson Davis, who was the president of the Confederacy, refused to apply for amnesty or ask for any kind of a pardon because he refused to say that he had done anything wrong. And it wasn't really until President Carter's administration that he was granted a pardon.
Hmm. Now, that wasn't the only pardon that President Carter granted. He also pardoned Vietnam draft evaders.
Yeah. You know, for all the contrasts we like to offer with Donald Trump and how he's using the pardon for political reasons, Carter ran on a platform of saying that he would pardon draft dodgers from Vietnam, that we needed to put this war behind us. And there were roughly 100,000 Americans who fled to Canada to avoid the draft, and that's a lot of people potentially to pardon.
When we look at what President Trump has been doing, some people are saying, well, this is a lot of pardons. In fact, there's a lot more publicity about these pardons that he's making, but he's really not at the high end of presidential pardons for this point in his presidency. Have some presidents exercised more of this power than others?
Absolutely. It is stunning how many presidents over a really long period of time, going back to George Washington, issued pardons. So we are so used to saying President Trump in an unprecedented action.
Right.
I mean, to be honest, so far, there's nothing particularly unprecedented about what Trump has done. All presidents have used pardons, and a lot of them have been politically motivated, to put it bluntly. Now, the question of him pardoning himself, that is unprecedented.
Well, and we'll get to that. But let's talk about one of the most controversial pardons in recent memory, which was Bill Clinton's pardon of Mark Rich, the fugitive financier. That pardon was made like almost a third of Clinton's pardons on his very last day in office.
That's exactly right. And Rich was certainly considered to be a tax evader. He had fled the country, and there were many charges that this was exactly the kind of pardon you don't want, a quid pro quo for a campaign contribution. And you really emphasized the key point, Jeremy. This happened at the very end of the Clinton administration. And I promise that I'm not vying to become part of Donald Trump's cabinet, but this is another place where we might want to give Trump actually some credit for the way he's using the pardon. Most presidents do wait to the end of their administrations, at least most recent presidents, to pardon large numbers of people, really. Trump is doing this not only at the rough beginning of his presidency, he's doing it even before the first midterm election. So if we do believe in transparency and holding the president accountable, he's saying, if you don't like this, go vote for a Democrat, but I think you are going to like this. He's willing to pay the political price of these pardons.
Has anyone ever refused a pardon?
Occasionally that has happened. I suppose most famously, the first time it happened, it puzzled people because they asked that very question. There was a fellow named George Wilson who robbed the National Mail, threatened the mail carrier, threatened his life. He and his partner were sentenced to death. Andrew Jackson, president at the time, issued a pardon. And Wilson, who was up for a variety of other related crimes, refused the pardon. I think probably because he wondered whether it would have some impact on whether he was considered guilty for these other crimes. But that raised the obvious question. Can you do that? If a president grants you a pardon, can you just say no? And there was a debate. And finally, the assumption was, well, in a sense, it's a gift. And if you don't accept that gift, then, yeah, you don't get it. So that indeed you can refuse a pardon.
Well, and in fact, I found out as I was looking into this that you can also take back a pardon as long as it hasn't been processed yet. The president can say, "I'm pardoning this person," and then if they
change my mind,
yeah. If Tom in accounting hasn't actually put it through, they can pull it back. So President Trump, as you said, Brian, has claimed that he has the power to pardon himself if need be. People have pointed out if he did that, he might well be impeached right away, although with the Republican Congress, who knows? But could a president pardon himself?
I think the answer is we don't know. I would say the consensus of legal thought is that he can't. For a couple of reasons. One, the language says grant a pardon. And in the normal use of the language, we don't grant things to ourselves. One wonders about Donald Trump. He grants things to himself all the time. But that aside, there is also a long-standing concept in the law that you cannot be a judge in your own trial. And that's a tradition within the judiciary itself that a lot of people argue would preclude Trump from granting a pardon to himself. That said, if you are a literalist and you read the Constitution literally and you interpret Grant in your favor, you can pardon yourself, argue some scholars.
I just wonder after this conversation where we got the term pardon me. I guess it wasn't literal. Brian Ballow and Joanne Freeman, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Thanks so much.
Thanks for
having
me.
Great to be here.
Asian American students are at the center of two high-profile lawsuits against affirmative action, one at Harvard, the other at the University of North Carolina. The plaintiffs say the schools discriminate against Asian American applicants in an effort to achieve student diversity. Both cases are sparking a lot of conversation in the Asian American community. Youth Radio's Sierra Fong Horvath reports.
For Asian American students, following the challenges to affirmative action at Harvard and the University of North Carolina can be a frustrating experience.
And I'm just kind of confused.
That's Emma DeShane. She's 21, born in China, but she grew up here in the U.S. She just finished up her junior year at UNC, and she doesn't agree with the lawsuit against her school.
Yeah, like annoyed and confused about like why this even seems necessary and why they can't see like the benefits that affirmative action brings other individuals.
In other words, she's worried these lawsuits could hurt her Black and Latino classmates if affirmative action is rolled back. She's not alone. The Asian American community is split on the efforts. On the one hand, there is history to Asians being discriminated against in the U.S., like the Chinese Exclusion Act, the 1882 law which prohibited Chinese workers from coming to America, and the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. But on the other hand, some people wonder if the lawsuits, which target race-based admissions, could make schools less diverse. In the 90s, California voted down affirmative action in public schools. And the year the ban took place, UC Berkeley saw admissions for underrepresented minorities, that's Black, Latino, and American Indian students, drop more than 50%, while Asian American admissions went up 8%. Now it's possible that what happened in California wasn't an anomaly, but a test case for what could happen for the rest of the country if these lawsuits against Harvard and UNC are successful. Jennifer Ho is a professor at UNC. She worries that the Asian American plaintiffs in the UNC case are so caught up in their own rejections that they're losing the big picture.
They don't have a full understanding of the history of race in the United States and the ways that they are being used in a larger narrative.
Before Asian Americans were suing to end affirmative action, a young white woman named Abigail Fisher brought her lawsuit against the University of Texas at Austin all the way to the Supreme Court. That case against race-based admissions ultimately failed. Although the plaintiffs in these anti-affirmative action lawsuits are all students, the cases were organized by a guy named Edward Bloom and his group, Students for Fair Admissions. When we asked to interview Bloom and his plaintiffs, he introduced us to Michael Wang instead. 5 years ago, Wang got rejected from his top school, Harvard,
I'm not saying that I should get into Harvard, but rather I'm just saying, was I treated equally with all students who applied to Harvard? Were we all on the same starting line?
Harvard's Director of Media Relations, Rachel Dane, sent a statement in response to our request for an interview. Part of it says, quote, "We will continue to vigorously defend the right of Harvard and other universities to seek the educational benefits that come from a class that is diverse on multiple dimensions," unquote. But many Asian American students are unconvinced. Wang has become the unofficial spokesperson for Asian Americans who feel like they didn't get a fair shake. While others with litigation pending have stayed quiet to avoid a backlash, he's keeping the issue alive by speaking out. Wang talks about how deeply invested his parents were in the college process.
When I received those rejection letters, I think a lot of people who apply to college will feel the same thing. They definitely feel disappointed, but not for only for themselves, but also for their parents.
I can relate. My mom is Chinese, so when my twin sister Hallie got her college admissions letters back,
yay, got into Brown.
Woo! Yay!
That shriek? Yep, that was my mom. I don't want to make her look like too much of a tiger mom, but she definitely expected at least one of her kids to get into an Ivy. And we both did. But when my sister and I were applying to college, we feared that race might count against us. You might guess that Michael Wang, who supports the lawsuits, is excited by their momentum now. But even he has mixed feelings.
I'm worried definitely that Asian Americans will end up being a tool in this. For example, you know, the whole Trump administration coming in be like, okay, like, let's investigate affirmative action. I was very skeptical about that because I felt all of a sudden he's interested in this issue. Like, I understand that this is part of Republican agenda.
Wang might be right. In April, the Trump administration's Department of Justice, which is siding with the group suing Harvard, pushed for the college to turn over a decade's worth of admissions files. Those records may directly impact the trial. For Here and Now, I'm Sierra Fong Horvath.
And Sierra's story was produced by Youth Radio. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.